Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Saturday morning, April the 9th, 2022. And I bet you that there are some people in the UK, specifically Rishi Sunak and spouse, who are happy that it is also the weekend in the UK, because there has been a fascinating discussion this week on tax residency, which does, I think, bear in citizenship taxation, and all of the above. And I am very fortunate today to have as my guest, as a return guest, Diane Gallen, who is a U.S. lawyer based in the U.K., a member of the New York Bar, I believe, who is very familiar with the UK tax residency rules generally, and of course these non-dom rules in particular. And thank you, Diane, for joining me to participate in this great discussion today. How are you?
I'm fine. Always a pleasure to hang out with you, John, and chat about not only world politics, but how world politics interfaces with tax.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is absolutely over the top, because, I mean, to set the factual background for our discussion today, and I don't think this is particularly controversial, apparently Rishi Sunak, who my perception is a rising star in UK politics, like many rising stars, has a spouse, and his spouse is not a UK citizen, but an India citizen who comes from a rather wealthy family, apparently founded Infosys, which, as I think back, I once visited on a trip to India years and years ago. But in any case, she is receiving dividends from an Indian company and perhaps other a non-UK source income, and interestingly, is able to exclude that from UK taxation, interesting, under the so-called non-dom regime. And Diane, I would think that you have a lot of experience with this, because it is a real benefit for people who emigrate to the UK. So could we begin with, you know, perhaps giving us a Reader's Digest view of how this thing works?
I mean, generally, the UK has a distinction between domicile and residence, which is a distinction that, you know, looking at it from a US point of view, we don't necessarily have. So domicile has been, you know, I like to think of domicile as some 19th century concept where maybe a British citizen went out to live in India or to live somewhere in, you know, as you know, the UK was colonizing the world. And they may have been resident of, we'll call it India, but their domicile would have still remained being, you know, English-based domicile, based on where they were born, based on the birthplace of their father. And that was something that would have been inherited by them, so that it didn't matter that, you know, this nice English person was, you know, helping to colonize the world. They would have been resident in India, domiciled, would have retained their domicile in the UK. And the way that that has then filtered down is that the UK essentially makes this distinction between residence and domicile. Residence being where you are physically present, domicile being this a completely different concept that is based on birth, and it might be based on where you intend to return. So, okay. You know, and what ties you might retain to your country of birth or the domicile that you may have inherited from your father.
So domicile sounds to me, and I think this is correct, as some sort of a more personal and permanent connection to a place, as
That's
opposed
right.
to necessarily a physical presence. And,
That's right.
you know, I think that you would agree that a number of jurisdictions define tax residency in terms of domicile. I think a number of U.S. states, for example.
Yes.
Et cetera. So domicile is, you know, alive and well as a basis for imposing tax residency. But it's also interesting to me that, you know, there are a number of different definitions of domicile and kinds of domicile. We have domicile of birth, we have domicile of dependence, we have domicile of choice. We have enough going on here so that I think that even people who aren't particularly creative may be able to claim domicile where they want. Would you agree?
Well, it's certainly such a broad definition, including, you know, as you mentioned, domicile of choice. You know, how do you get, you know, do you get to choose your domicile?
Right. And
and how do you get to choose your domicile? On what basis? Is it, yeah, you know, and how, and does marriage come into play in this? What teams do you get to root for?
Yeah, well, I think historically marriage did matter. I think there was a time when a married, you know, going back 100 years or more, where a married woman would have presumably had the domicile of her husband, right?
That's right. And it's not even hundreds of years ago. I mean, that's recent, you know, that's way more recent than that, that a woman, a non-UK spouse, a non-UK woman who married then a British man would have taken that his domicile.
Right. And also interestingly, if we look at this from a US point of view, the income tax residency rules are not based on domicile, but interestingly, the estate and gift tax rules are, unless you're a US citizen, based on domicile, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So this is, you know, this is interesting stuff, and, you know, I think provides the basis for some very, very creative tax planning. Now, moving this into the UK situation. So my understanding of this is that that residency is one thing, domicile is another, and for UK tax residents who are not domiciled in the UK, and this is a bit of an oversimplification, but it would appear to be possible to exclude from their taxable income, income sourced outside the UK. Have I got that right?
That's right. So if you're not domiciled in the UK for a particular, and you claim that status, and you claim it either by, you know, number of years that you've resided in, physically present in the UK, or you claim that status by paying a fee, which currently is £30,000, you can simply be taxed, you will simply be taxed on your UK source income. So any other income arising outside the UK is not subject to UK tax. Unless it is remitted into the UK.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Rules.
So if they want to operate their non-UK source income as totally offshore, so to speak,
right,
make sure it stays offshore, then it's simply excludable from the reportable income in the UK. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, now you mentioned that they're paying a £30,000 fee to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And presumably they're paying expensive legal and tax advisors as well. So would it be fair to say that somebody who took the position they were a non-dom would have to perceive significant tax savings in so doing?
Absolutely. So, you know, if you're looking at your fees, I mean, you must have a tax saving of, you know, much way more than £30,000, plus, as you say, legal fees, accounting fees, and everybody else who is, you know, assisting and advising keeping, you know, what income you can keep outside the UK tax net and how to do it.
Right. And of course, to be clear here, and I think that this is not acknowledged enough in the media, the fact that this money is not taxable in the UK, that is excluded from income in the UK, does not mean that it's not taxed by another jurisdiction, correct?
That's absolutely right. And that's what's been missing, I think, from some of the coverage in the UK about Rishi Sunak's wife.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you completely, because when you read this stuff, you get the feeling as though, you know, this income is, because it's excluded from tax in the UK, therefore it's not taxed anywhere. It reminds me very much of, you know, resident Americans who take the position that a US citizen living abroad doesn't, you know, if it doesn't pay tax in the US, somehow doesn't pay tax anywhere else, right?
The same, right.
You know, it's mm-hmm. the same idiocy.
Right.
However, it is fairly clear that no matter how you look at this, there is a tax, there would have to be a tax benefit to doing this, or nobody would pay, you know, what's starting at 30,000 pounds, and I suspect maybe close to 100,000 pounds, you know, by the time, mm-hmm. you know, all these advisors, you know, get their share, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, can I ask you, I mean, you are a long time U.S. Lawyer in the U.K. You know, so you've got a U.S. I mean, presuming that, you know, you've had many U.S. citizens over the years consult you. I mean, is it reasonable for a U.S. citizen moving to the U.K. to possibly take advantage of this as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's not a law that's that only deals with one particular jurisdiction. It has been incredibly helpful to many of my clients who, you know, in their initial move to the UK will claim non-DOM status. So yes, Americans moving over, absolutely.
It's really something. And because they're US citizens, they're still subject to, well, they're not subject to the
PNR. Well, so I mean, the issue has always been in the past is, you know, so they'll be paying tax in the US on their worldwide income. They'll be paying tax in the UK on only their UK source income. So the question has always been is, what is the differential between the two tax rates? Are you going to save 2%? Are you going to save 5%? So when the US, when the UK had a much higher tax rate, the differential was much higher, and it was worth that, you know, it was worth claiming that non-DOM status. So that's what you're looking at, that tax differential, to look at how much tax you are actually saving.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, somebody like that, would not be renouncing U.S. citizenship because they'd want to take advantage of presumptively lower tax rates, I think.
Right.
But let me hypothesize an example. Let's say I come to you, and of course, this would never be me because I don't have money, but I'm just going to fantasize for a minute. That
you go fantasize.
I'm going to fantasize, and I am a rich American citizen.
That's another fantasy, John.
Actually, okay, yes, you're right. Yeah, it's being increasingly difficult to be a rich American citizen. You would agree?
Yes.
In fact, American citizenship is probably the fastest and most direct and predictable way to the poorhouse, I can imagine, particularly if you're an American abroad. But let's imagine a long time ago, 100 years ago, when it was still possible to be a rich American. So I have an investment portfolio of, I don't know, $100 million or something like this. And I want to move to, I've always wanted to live in London. I just love London. I love the theater. I love the history. I love the underground, all of these things. So I come to you, Diane, and I say, you know, so tell me, how do I move to London and minimize my taxation? And how would you take me through the analysis here?
So we'd first look at, you know, what, how much tax you might be paying in the US. So you have to look at both your federal tax and add in the state tax component. So for somebody who's living in a high tax state jurisdiction, like New York or California, you're paying well over 50, you could be paying well over 50% tax. So then the analysis then looks at, well, what will you be what tax will you be paying in the UK on that same income if you were reporting all of it? And then you remove the state component on the basis that you can probably get out of not paying state tax because you are no longer physically present in a state. So let's assume we can remove the state tax component. So now you're looking at the difference between US federal tax and UK tax as a whole. So then you're looking at how are those, you know, what rates are being assessed on different kinds of income. So you're looking at, you know, ordinary income, wages, maybe interest income, and what the rates are between the two jurisdictions. You're also then looking at capital gains tax rates, which have a differential between the US and the UK. And, you know, and you basically plug in some numbers on a spreadsheet and you do a kind of analysis of where you're better off tax-wise.
Okay, and if you don't claim non-dom status, then presumably you are including the U.S. income in your British income and you are claiming a tax credit for tax in the U.S.
That's right. So on your U.S. return, which you will still have to continue to file, as we all know, you will then be able to claim a tax credit. So there's also some differentials as to, you know, not to go into it, you know, is timing of the payment of the UK tax, but also does the US in any circumstances have the first right to tax any income, even though you might not be living in the US, such as, you know, a slice perhaps of dividend income.
Yeah, interest.
And how the tax credits work. And are you going to be able to get full benefit of the UK tax that you're paying on the same income you're reporting on your US return?
Right.
So it's a big puzzle. And I always have liked puzzles, but that's really what it is you're plugging numbers in as if it's a big puzzle.
Okay.
So it's looking back and forth between the credits. And sometimes you can get credits for US tax that's paid on your UK return. So, you know, it's highly, as we know, a complex set of rules that needs to be looked at carefully before one, you know, thinks about whether claiming non-dom status has actually been, you know, how much tax are you really going to save?
Well, that's right. And that, you know, that's actually a very, very good analysis. So, I mean, you know, you need to look at the tax credits, but also you need to look very carefully at the sourcing rules.
Right. And again, most of my clients actually will be saving tax when they, you know, saving tax because you take out that state level tax.
Right.
So in fact, you know, their overall tax rate will be significantly less than what they paid overall when they were living in the U.S.
Right. So the state tax component does make the non-dom status somewhat more attractive, I think, presumptively, correct?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the state tax thing, though, let's just bore down a little on this. Some of these states have pretty sticky tax residency rules. And in fact, mm-hmm. you find this stuff in terms of domicile. I mean, do you think that somebody could... I believe that Massachusetts, I may be wrong, but I believe that Massachusetts is a state that may define tax residency in terms of domicile. You know, or let's just pick anyone. I mean, is it possible to claim from a UK point of view that you're not domiciled in the UK and claim that you're also not domiciled in the last state that you lived in?
I think that would be harder because if you claim that you are not domiciled in the UK, you must claim that you are domiciled somewhere else. And you cannot be domiciled in the United States. It is a domicile that relates to a particular state.
So if we were dealing with somebody with a lot of money and a lot of time to plan, then it seems to me that one consideration might be switching the state domicile before the move to the UK. Would that be reasonable?
Yes, that's right. And you might look at some of the various states that don't have a state income tax, Florida, Texas, Nevada, for example. Mm-hmm. Or you might look at states that, you know, the rules are very clear that they do not tax domiciled individuals.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I would agree with you on that. And I think it's very, very important, particularly given the heightened aggressiveness of these tax jurisdictions now, to not be in a position where you're sort of trying to suck and blow at the same time. You know, hey, no, of course I'm not domiciled in the UK you know, and but then on the U.S. side, of course, I'm not domiciled in Massachusetts.
Right. And, you know, and then, you know, it opens up a whole other can of worms. Are you voting? Do you still have a driver's license? Do you have a house that you're renting? Do you have a, you know, do you have a house that is available for you to come back to the state? Have you, you know, left this, you know, empty house somewhere? Do you have a burial plot? There are all kinds of, you know, issues then that you need to start asking.
God, life is complicated, isn't it? Well, let's move back to, you know, the big
news. Let's move back to Rishi.
Because, I mean, nobody cares about the people we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But this is really, really hot stuff because, you know, we have this rising star in British politics who's married to this wealthy Indian national. And, you know, I mean, the pictures that I see of them in the papers the last week, they seem pretty glamorous people to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it'd be very easy for people to resent this, for the general public to resent this. And apparently that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But let's remind listeners that this does not mean that that she is not paying tax somewhere else. Okay. I find it very hard to believe that any of this non-US source income is not being taxed. Non-UK source income not being taxed. I just don't believe it. I think it's just being taxed at a much lower rate for whatever reason.
Right.
Now let's focus on this a little bit. You know, we've talked about domicile. But what's interesting is that everything I've read, and I, you know, full disclosure, I'm basing this on what I have read. I don't know these people. I'm a commoner, okay? I don't know anybody. I don't know any royalty anywhere, okay? But everything I've read suggests that the claim to not being domiciled in the UK is because she's a citizen of India. And that India doesn't allow dual citizenship. So whether India does or does not allow dual citizenship, do you think that there's any particular presumptive relationship between her not being a UK citizen and therefore her not being domiciled in the UK?
I would think that one would assume that having Indian citizenship would mean that she is not domiciled in the UK based on their domicile rules, as I understand them.
Based on whose domicile rules?
On the UK's domicile rules. Okay. Unless she was acquiring a domicile because a UK domicile based on the fact that her husband is UK domiciled.
Right.
Which goes back to, you know, presumption that was certainly in effect, you know, even in the 1960s and 1970s in the UK, that a woman acquired her husband's domicile on marriage.
That was the presumption in the 60s and 70s, as recently as?
Yeah. As far as I understand it, yes.
That's extraordinary, actually. Okay.
I'll give you a little aside. For all the same reasons that until the 60s that the child of a British woman who was married to a non-British spouse and that child was born outside the UK was not able to inherit their mother's citizenship. Had it been reversed and had a child been born outside the UK to a British father, they would have inherited their British citizenship. But born outside the UK to a British mother, where you know for sure who the parent is, that child would not have inherited British citizenship.
That was exactly
until the late 70s.
Yeah, now this is interesting because that was the law of citizenship in Canada up until 1977.
Right. Well, it's about the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
Same
so from 19
in the UK.
from 1949 to 1977 in Canada, the Citizenship Act, when it describes the status of people born abroad, was exactly that. Mm-hmm. That if it's a child is born to a married couple, all right, the citizenship comes from the father, right? If the father right. was Canadian, the child would be Canadian, but not from the mother.
Right.
And, you know, as an expatriation lawyer, you know, you would be sensitive to the dual citizenship at birth exemption from the exit tax, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And that's always an issue. You know, those children can now acquire British citizenship right. based on their mother, but that doesn't mean that that's what they acquired at birth. So for the expatriation rules.
Yeah, well, Canada has changed its law so that they are deemed to be Canadians from birth.
Right, now. And I don't think the UK has not changed its law.
Yeah, so I mean, it's just amazing how citizenship, you know, this incredibly arbitrary stuff, you know, runs through this whole problem. So here we are. Mm-hmm. All right, and in any case. I mean, I think that one could reasonably question whether, you know, the domicile, whether she can claim non-dom status based simply on not being a UK citizen. But whatever, that's what they did. It was clearly accepted because they paid the £30,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and then we have all this outrage, you know, from the British public. And you know, the media is saying, well, you know, come on. I mean, you know, she's not a UK citizen. And the outrage is, what does that have to do with anything? I mean, not only does she live here, but she lives publicly, you know, the wife of this rising star of UK politics. I mean, are you telling me that her lack of British citizenship somehow means that she shouldn't pay tax on worldwide income? I mean, that's when she,
when she is resident, clearly living in the UK.
Not only living there, but people can see her, like, you know, often, I think, often. I mean, you know, she is in the public eye, as is her husband. Now, it occurs to me that, you know, I think the British public is justified. I mean, they might not know the tax residency rules. They might not know the intricacies of all this stuff. But even a dog knows whether he's been kicked or tripped over. And, you know, it's pretty obvious that this is unfair, just on a moral level, right? It's unfair to the average.
It has an appearance of unfairness, and that's what counts in politics.
Okay, it has an appearance. The appearance, though, is largely based on the notion that, hey, this should not be driven by her citizenship. It should be driven by where she lives. And, you know, I mean, my thought on this, isn't the British public, through their outrage, making the best argument against citizenship taxation there could be?
Good flip, Mr. Richardson. Absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think these Americans abroad group, I mean, I think they should make hay of this. I think they need to get all these British journalists and the general public involved. I think they should go around the country and saying, hey, do you think that Rishi Sunak's wife should be exempt from worldwide taxation because she's not a British citizen?
Mm-hmm.
I say, no, 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 no. Next question. Do you think that if she were a British citizen, that in itself, if she weren't living in the UK, should she be taxed? Probably no, no, no.
No, probably no. Because exactly. We have millions and millions of British citizens living all over the world, especially in Spain and other countries where the sun shines more frequently, who are indeed not taxed on their worldwide income because they are not physically present in the UK.
So what do you think? I mean, do you not see this as an argument against citizenship taxation?
Yes. Yeah.
Not that we need any more, okay?
No, I think we have a nice long laundry list, but this is, you can add it to the list.
Well, we can add it because now we've got, you know, nobody cares about Americans, right? They deserve it. They're Americans. I mean, they should be punished for being American. I miss the general consensus in the world.
Well, we're the pariahs of the world, so absolutely.
Exactly. Yes. So, yeah. You know.
Or we're right up there with the pariahs of the world.
Well, you know, now they're now Russian citizens are being sanctioned because they're Russian. I mean, you know, good on them. They know what it feels like to be American and living under sanctions 24/7 just because they're Americans, right? But no, it's interesting, you know, how all these things blend together. So apparently what she said now is that, now this $30,000, this is something they apply for. They, you know, they, is that the right word? They apply.
Well, you make a choice. You know, it's literally a tick the box, make a choice on a UK tax return.
Okay. So it's like a check the box election in the subpart F regime.
And the good news, and from a UK point of view, you can check it 1 year and not check it the next year and go back and check it. You can go back and forth between paying the $30,000.
So you mean you can reevaluate it every year and check
it? Every year you can reevaluate your status.
Oh my God, this is unbelievable. I mean, I I've always loved London, but well, of course I don't have enough money to make a difference, but boy, if I had money, I think I'd be looking at the UK as a possible good place to live for tax purposes.
It's always been, you know, from my view, you know, one of the tax havens for the wealthy, which is why it is, you know, attracts certain wealthy individuals, as we have found out recently.
Is that why they call it London grad?
Yes. London yes. Grad. Based on the numbers of those folks, from the country of Russia who have moved to the UK, moved to London in particular.
Yeah, well, you know, you're right about Americans being poor. I mean, when I was growing up, you know, I was very young, you know, I think there was this perception that North America, you know, they had more money, higher standard of living. Now, as far as I can see, North Americans are, you know, rapidly becoming some of the poorest people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know it, but that's what it means. That's what it means. All right. Now, basically what she's done, now, if I'm reading the media properly, there was an announcement yesterday that, by God, she is going to pay tax on this money in the UK. So what that really means is that she's going to just check the box. She's not going to check the box this year.
She's not going to check the box that she's non-dom. That's right.
Okay. So it means then, presumably, that what would happen is that she takes a tax credit in the UK for tax paid wherever else it may be. Is that a fair statement?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it doesn't mean she goes from not paying any tax to paying tax. It means that she just goes to paying more tax.
We presume it's paying more tax. That's right. Yeah. And
She's paying all this money for the non-dom status, I think it's probably the case. But okay.
Yeah, it's probably the case that it has saved her, as they would say in the UK, a bit of dosh.
I think so. All right. Well, she's giving it up to, you know, to help her husband's political career. I think that's good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another interesting aspect of this, I mean, this was fascinating in and of itself, totally fascinating. I mean, you know, you look at this Rishi Sunak and, you know, so he's the Chancellor of the Exchequer. But also, I mean, he was the lead sort of person in, you know, I think the Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, the minimum tax discussions, right? You know, the reform of the rules of international tax. So at the same time, this guy is saying, well, you know, got to have minimum tax on these corporations and that, it seems to me that he has going on in his family a rather good tax minimization gig going on, right?
Yeah, I mean, here's the chancellor who is convincing the British population to pay tax, and in his bedroom, he's saying to his wife, "You don't even need to pay tax."
Well, you know,
wait for you not to pay tax.
I think that's interesting. Well, you know, as former Prime Minister of Canada, going back many years, the first Prime Minister Trudeau, you know, used to say the state has no business in the bedrooms of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's a validation of that principle. But, you know, coming back to North America, I mean, it was a great story to begin with. And I think would have been a great law school exam question, right? An international tax. But, my God, just when it was really exciting, it got even more exciting when it turns out these people had green cards.
I know.
Oh my God. I mean, the
kiss. Oh my God, we're adding another level of tax.
Well, that's right. And maybe we can talk about that on avoidance through the tiebreaker election. But mm-hmm. All right, so.
And made a decision not to go to his beach house, not for them both to go to their beach house in Santa Monica overlooking the Pacific Ocean for the Easter break.
They're not there.
No, they're not in California, apparently.
Why not?
I don't know if it's about not wanting to spend time in the U.S., how they were going to enter, I don't know.
Or maybe they just have a better offer somewhere else. That's entirely...
You know, but he certainly has, but he does maintain this home in the state of California. That is available to him 365 days of the year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but he's a non-resident alien now, right? So he's a non-resident alien, or she is, owning this thing. I mean, wouldn't that open the door to possible estate tax issues? And what if they die?
I don't know. I hadn't thought about that. Where their estate would be subject to tax. Again, you've got, you know, foreign tax, you know, got credits between, you know, under treaties between them, between
well,
the
there
various
is, there
countries
is no state
they could
tax
possibly, treaties. You know, it also depends on where their assets are. So we know they have an asset, at least they have one asset in California, a very expensive apartment. And that would indeed be subject to U.S. estate tax.
Well, there's a treaty, though. There's an estate tax treaty.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm actually, at this point, I am so glad that I don't have the problems that all these people with money do.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine having to live this way?
Well, I would get it. Well, it's, you know, whether the tax, you know, whether the tax wags the dog. So, you know, how are you going to live your life? Which is what I say to my clients all the time. You can't think about tax. Think about, you know, how you want to live your life without thinking about tax.
I think that's right. But I think that sometimes the situation gets so complicated, the thing about tax is just imposed on people. Mm-hmm. But let's explore this whole green card thing, which, you know, is fascinating.
Yeah. And so apparently they have, you know, issued a statement that they no longer have green cards, but nobody is aware of when they might have given up their green cards, whether that was last week or last year, whether he was given up when he was chancellor or when he was serving, you know, when that happened.
All right, maybe you could take us through just the Reader's Digest version of how green card holders are subject to U.S. tax.
So the Reader's Digest version goes is that all U.S. citizens and U.S. green card holders are subject to tax on their worldwide income, irregardless of where they might be physically present in the world.
Okay. So they're really, in many respects, treated as though they're citizens. But the difference between a citizen and a green card holder is that a green card holder can use a tax treaty to cease to be a U.S. tax resident, right?
That's right. And so a green card holder has many more perks about their ability to not pay U.S. tax.
Do you think it's true that anything is better than being a U.S. citizen?
from a tax point of view, being a citizen of any other country around the world might have give you a better result.
All right. So presumably, right. Now, if a green card holder is taxed on worldwide income, then my understanding is that both of them had green cards, then
right.
Absent the use of a tax treaty tie break,
mm-hmm.
his wife's income would be taxed in the U.S., right?
Yes.
What a horrible result. Now, The reason I put it that way is that the tax treaty, for to use a tax treaty tie break, you have to be a tax resident of the United States and of another country. So isn't it true that
assuming so we have to look at what her, we have to look at what her other country is, and her exactly. other country will not be the, will not be under the facts that I am aware of, or that you might be aware of, her tax, her taxation is, you know, it's not UK tax. We're looking at the treaty between India and the US.
But is she a tax resident of India?
I don't know.
Well, but she is a tax residency resident
of the U.S. She's a resident of the U.K., non-domiciled.
But
so, yes, I guess we're looking at which tax treaty applies.
Yeah, I would guess it's the U.K. tax treaty.
Yeah, no, I agree now, yes.
So this is really, really fascinating. I mean, just think of this. Like, this is just, I mean, you can't make this stuff up, right? So here we have her.
So here we have a potential U.S. tax resident, U.S., a person subject to U.S. tax on their worldwide income, taking what the treaty benefit of the U.K., because that is where they are physically present and resident, but under U.K. rules, not paying tax on their worldwide income because they are domiciled, yet another level, in a country outside the U.K., which is not the United States, and in this case, India, right? So we've got three levels that we're looking at.
Oh my God. I mean, you put that so well. Have you ever thought of becoming a tax teacher or a tax residency professor? That was great. But I mean, you can see the craziness of this, right? I mean, she's claiming effectively, okay, that she's not really a complete U.S. tax resident because she's a non-dom, right? But under the treaty, right. The U.K. tax resident, allowing her to claim that she's not a U.S. tax resident to avoid the inclusion of that income on her U.S. return, right?
That's right.
It's unbelievable. Do you think we should write a play in 3 or 4 acts?
Nobody will care.
That's the thing. Nobody will care. But the British public seems to be upset about this.
Well, the British public's very upset about it. And yeah.
And they're upset fundamentally because they don't think the claim that she's not a British citizen should get her off paying tax, right?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it is at its core.
I mean, it is the unfairness of that 1% of the population who, you know, we perceive as not paying tax or paying low tax or somehow.
Well, not paying tax too. The problem is that people can't see beyond the tax jurisdiction they live in. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's clear, and in fairness, all this. I mean, it is funny, right? But I think in fairness, we do need to reinforce that she is. It's impossible for me to believe she's not paying any tax on that somewhere.
Yeah, I just don't know India law, so we're going to presume she's paying something somewhere.
Yeah, okay, but we know for sure that given the amount of money she's paying for this non-dom status, that there are significant tax savings. But you know, there's another dimension to this that you will appreciate. Being a lawyer who focuses on this type of stuff, but so they have the green cards. And we know that just the fact of having a green card makes them a U.S. tax resident.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that definitely gets them out of, it means they're taxable only on U.S. source income. But what about things like FBAR? So we have this situation where Mr. Sunak is the chancellor of the exchequer. And, you know, that actually seems to me to be probably the most important political position in the country. I mean, is he subject to FBAR requirements and FBAR penalties?
If he was filing, you know, my view is that if he was filing a U.S. tax return and claiming the benefits of the tiebreaker rules under the U.S.-UK treaty, that he would still be required to file an FBAR during that period of time that he might have been filing a non-resident U.S. tax return. Because right. I don't think the FBAR rules follow the ability to claim non-resident status based on a treaty tiebreak position.
That and, the treaty tiebreak
position, we should say, is based on the fact that you consider yourself to be more resident in one country than another country by looking at certain factors.
Right. Okay. Of which, interestingly, talking about the treaty tiebreak, I mean, another aspect of this that's fascinating is, you know, we're talking about citizenship or lack thereof. How does citizenship or lack thereof factor into the treaty tiebreak? And what's interesting is the least citizenship is the least important issue.
That's right. It's the last one on the list.
Exactly. It's number four right there at the bottom.
Yeah. I mean, what's at the top that you have a permanent home.
Permanent home. Yeah.
And he has a home in California. So
under
that basis.
This is unbelievable. Well, but he also saying the position he has a permanent home in both countries, right?
That's right. So he has a permanent home in both countries. His center of vital interest, he'll claim, is the UK.
Which I think it is.
But yeah, of course it is. And in any event, his citizenship, his British citizenship, will cut to the tiebreak to the UK.
Yeah, if it goes down that far. But again, right. My point is the citizenship is the least relevant, right, for this.
Right.
And it's becoming, you know, somehow he's arguing is the most relevant for the non-dom status. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, so, if the most relevance is where you have a permanent home.
Under the treaty tiebreak rules.
Under the treaty tiebreak rules, yeah.
Okay. Now, so we have, I mean, it's clear that there's some overlap between having the green card and, you know, really having a very significant political responsibility in the British government. And mm-hmm. I think that probably he is subject to the FR rules, because there's no suggestion in this case that using the tiebreak resulted in expatriation, okay? In other words, he continues his U.S. tax residency.
Mm-hmm.
I really am uncomfortable with the idea that the Chancellor of the Exchequer could somehow be subject to FBAR penalties from the U.S. government. What do you think of that?
That he could be subject? Well,
if he has to file an FBAR, and if he doesn't,
well, my plain English ruling and my plain English reading, I should say, is that he would suffer FBAR penalties if he did not file an FBAR during the period of time he held his green card. And I don't think it matters that he was a chancellor or not. He was certainly, you know, even before he became the chancellor, he's still a member of parliament, which I think still carries...
Yeah, I think
it, you know, a political weight to that.
I mean, do you think that that it's reasonable to require anybody who's involved in the in government in other countries to almost certify they have no U.S. status?
Well, I know you. I don't know. I mean, it's a political issue. And I'm not sure I want to touch that.
Well, you know, they are subject to a form of coercion, right? You know, on this. I mean, I think it's a very interesting problem. For example, somebody responsible for whether to sign a FATCA IGA being subject to the possibility of FBAR penalties?
Well, he is the person who is enforcing FBAR penalties against financial institutions in the UK. He has a hand in that. He's not enforcing, but
I don't think this is a good fact. I really don't think this is a good fact. I mean, and I think of that and sort of a hidden level is just as significant as all this other stuff. I mean, the reality is this. Look, the non-dom thing, they're behaving perfectly legally, right? Absolutely.
They have done nothing illegal. They are absolutely following rules that have been in existence for hundreds of years.
Yep. I mean, I don't think they've done anything illegal anywhere. I mean, I don't see
it. Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah. Well, it doesn't look like they have. Looks like they followed whatever U.S. rules may have been required of them.
No, I mean, it's really just an indictment of the system itself and the absurdity of a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, it's whether it's an appearance of unfairness.
Well, it is an appearance of unfairness, and I think that one could take a step further and say that it probably is unfair for you know, for her to not be paying world, you know, subject to worldwide taxation on that income if she lives in the UK, probably.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But certainly, at a minimum, there's no question there's an appearance of it. And what if anything do you think is likely to come of this? I mean, so she's unchecked the box. I'm no longer checking the non-dom box.
Mm-hmm.
You think that'll be the end of it?
I have no idea. I mean, the British public remembers things for a long time to come.
Really?
So
it may be the difference between British and North Americans.
A short attention span. I think the Brits have a longer attention span.
Well, they still have newspapers there.
But I think, you know, you know, I have no idea if and when this ever blows over, that she will then in a subsequent year go back to claiming being a non-dom, depending on where her husband is in politics.
Well, the non-dom rules have been evolving over the years. I think that this 15-year limitation before it begins to erode, it goes back to 2015 or 16, doesn't it?
I think it begins to erode now. Doesn't it begin to erode after? It has different rules as to when it begins to erode, whether it's for a state tax or.
But anyway, it doesn't go on forever.
It doesn't go on forever. It has an end date. And after its end date is when you can choose to pay the fee.
Right. All right. Well, this is fascinating. Great discussion here. I mean, let's say that, you know, that they had the good sense to consult you instead of their $1 million, whoever they are. What would be a message or a piece of advice that you would give for them?
Well, it would depend on whether he wants to continue his career in politics. And my advice would be, if you want to continue your career in politics on the level that it looks like you wish to achieve, then you will have your wife not check the non-dom box on their tax return.
Well, I think that's very, very practical advice. And if he says, well, come on, it's all legal, isn't it? It's all legal. Your response would be?
It's absolutely all legal. I don't suggest that he changes the tax laws. I just suggest that they rethink her position.
So you'd say, look, checking the box is an option.
That's right.
It's really not an option for you.
Mm-hmm. Not an option for you because of your ambitions in politics.
Yeah, I think that's very accurate. Well, Diane, this has been great. I always enjoy these discussions with you.
Always lovely to chat with you, John.
And I think, boy, we've, you know, we've explored this from a number of different dimensions.
And, right. You know, it brings us back to citizenship-based taxation.
Well, the outrage for Americans. The root of the outrage is, come on, she can't avoid tax because she's not a citizen, right? I mean, yep. The outrage really is based on the relationship between citizenship and taxation.
That's right. Every reason to end it.
Every reason to end it. That's exactly right. Diane, how would people get in touch with you if they wanted to for more of your incredibly extensive knowledge in this area?
Best reach always by email. Very simple. It's diane@dianegellin.com. You just need to know how to spell my name, which is D-I-A-N-E. Surname is G-E-L-O-N. So best way to reach me is diane@dianegellin.com.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
I look forward to our continued discussions.
Sounds good.